In the name of God, most merciful and most compassionate, good evening everyone. It's a pleasure to be back in Fresno, and I hope you have all had a wonderful and happy Ramadan so far. Last month, I had a lecture on Islamic mysticism. For those of you who were present at that lecture, I made references to the notion of divine love, but I didn't have enough time to get into the nitty-gritty details of the notion of divine love, and some people showed an interest in that, and so I decided to dedicate tonight's lecture to the concept of divine love, or in Farsi we call it Ishq-e Ilahi. Ever since the human race appeared on earth, humanity has been preoccupied with the notion of love. Much of our literature and arts are in celebration of love. We admire lovers to the point of envy. It is often said that love makes the impossible possible. It is love that makes the world go round. These all may sound like romantic sentiments. However, there is a ring of truth in these statements. Love, in fact, is the most effective instrument for success in any endeavor that requires devotion and dedication. Great works of art, scientific inventions, athletic achievements, and personal triumph, these are typically all accomplished by a heart that is filled with love. If somebody is short on love, none of these accomplishments are indeed possible. A heart must be filled with a worthy cause if someone is to survive the hardships and difficulties that exist on the path on these triumphs. Spiritual quest is no exception to this rule. Love is a strong bond. It is an intense affection that originates in the heart and radiates outside. It affects the person carrying it, and it impacts the community in which the loving person lives. Love is often a yearning between two human beings. We are also familiar with love between a human being and a cause. For example, the cause for social justice. Can love exist between a man or a woman and God? You see, the love between two human beings, the love between a person and a cause, is something that our imagination can wrap its arms around it. But the love between a human being and God is not all that intuitive. How does divine love manifest itself? And what are the characteristics of such a love between God and a human being? The mystical literature in all world religions is filled with a discourse on the concept of divine love. And let me make a point at the outset. Muslims tend to have a lot of problem with the concept of divine love for whatever reason. I give lectures around the country on the topic of love, and Christians who attend my lectures, they are at ease with my talks. Muslims, for whatever reason, they have a very hard time picturing the notion of love. And probably tonight you will figure out and understand why it is that Muslims tend to have a hard time with it. Not that this concept is alien to Islam. It's just that over the past couple of hundred years, something has happened in the Islamic world that has caused Muslims to somehow not appreciate their own cultural legacy. It's people like me who go around the country and others around the world reminding Muslims about this rich cultural heritage that they have. Last time I was here, I made a reference to a fact that up until 200 years ago, the mystic perspective was the dominant perspective in the Islamic world. It's only over the past couple of hundred years that mysticism has been on the decline in the Islamic world. There used to be a time where Sufis were held in very high regard in the Islamic world. These days, Muslims tend to look at their theology mostly from a philosophical, rationalistic perspective, which I think it's a bit of a disservice to Islamic theology. Now, tonight I will present an introduction to the concept of divine love. I will discuss some of the most important characteristics of divine love, and I will draw upon both Islamic and Christian sources. So the Christians in the audience should find a lot in common between the mystic traditions of Islam and Christianity. And in fact, both religions have substantially provided great insights to humanity on this very important issue. With this introduction, let me begin the heart of the lecture tonight. What is divine love? What does it really mean when we say love can exist between a person and the divine or God? Let me give you a 1 minute refresher on the concept of religion, like religion 101, very briefly. At the core of every religion, Islam, Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, Hinduism, it doesn't matter. At the heart of every single religion in the world lies three important principles. Principle number one, God exists. Principle number two is that humanity lives in very tragic circumstances. It may sound not that intuitive when I mention that in every religion, for example, Islam and Christianity, you have the notion of the descendants of humanity from an original state. We've all heard of the story of Adam and Eve in monotheistic tradition. It's just a metaphor, not that really something like that ever happened in the history of humanity. It's just a metaphor that humanity has descended from its original state of being one with God or the divine. Now, as soon as humanity descends from the original state, you have the tragic conditions of life under which we live. Principle number three is the notion of the promise of salvation. Every religion has to provide a hope for a way out of this tragic state of life. According to all theologies, human life is full of darkness, misery, and injustice in the absence of God. In other words, if we lead a life in which God is not present, our lives will be filled with darkness, with misery, and with injustice. Now, salvation from this predicament is only possible if humanity harmonizes himself with the cosmic wisdom and order which we call God. So for those of you who are more philosophically minded, God stands for the cosmic awareness, cosmic wisdom, and cosmic harmony. That's exactly what salvation means. It means to be able to free yourself from that tragic state of life, enter light from darkness, enter happiness from misery. And this transformation is only possible if you can find harmony between yourself and the world at large. The opposite means if you are not in harmony with this cosmic order this cosmic wisdom we call God, then your life is going to be filled with tension, with anxiety, with depression, and constant disappointments. You see, that's what Buddhists always teach us. Buddhist theology teaches that the life keeps only one promise, and that's misery. In other words, it's one promise life always keeps. Now, if you want to overcome this inherent misery in the state of life, you ought to be able to find God or this cosmic awareness, cosmic order, and cosmic wisdom. Now, the question is this. How can we achieve harmony with God? Harmony is only possible when you obey God, when you obey His wisdom, and when you obey His will. So you must be able to find obedience in your life in relation to God. Having said that, what is the mechanism that can realize this obedience? How can we ensure that we can obey God's will, God's wisdom, and God's commands? As it turns out, throughout history, most religions have dwelled on the notion of fear as the most beneficial and most significant instrument in order to secure obedience to God. Instilling fear of punishment and hellfire, according to most religious folks, will induce the correct attitude and the correct behavior in people. Christianity during the Middle Ages, for a whole 1,000 years, basically operated based upon this mechanism for salvation. Did you know that when Christianity took roots in Europe, especially the Catholic Church, one of the first order of business was to destroy all the comic books written during the Roman and during the Greek era in human civilization. All the books of comics, they all were destroyed. Do you know why? For a simple reason. When people laugh a lot, fear will go away. Fear will go away. Today in the Islamic world, we see that every day. That there is something, it's as if there is something in laughter, in joy, in being cheerful, that will separate us from God. It's a misnomer, but nonetheless, it has been emphasized throughout history in all religious traditions. Now, mystics, on the other hand, have always argued that fear may be a useful tool to change human behavior mechanically. In other words, if you want to force somebody to change his or her behavior mechanically, yes, you can basically instill fear in that person. However, religion is a spiritual quest. It is not exactly the same thing as mechanical behavioral modification. You cannot force anybody in order to find God. So you need a lot more than fear to successfully complete your spiritual journey, according to the mystics. And I can tell you very frankly that one of the greatest discoveries by mystics in spiritual development is the notion of love. It was really the mystics in the world who first stumbled across this notion that love can be an effective instrument, an effective force in spiritual development. Mystics realized that if one is not riding on love, he cannot have much success in obeying God. If his heart is not filled with affection and devotion, he will not be able to endure the hardships that inevitably will show up in this spiritual quest. Now, what are some of the hardships that we will ultimately encounter on the path to God and in our spiritual development? The inner struggles that we have to go through to overcome evil and vices. It's not that easy to say no to vices. Actually, it's very difficult. For Muslims, the month of Ramadan is the month of self-purification, right? Tazkiyah nafs. That's one of the things that we Muslims practice a lot in this holy month. Self-purification is not that easy. It's actually extremely difficult to say no to a part of yourself. Self-purification. It is as if something has resided inside you that is not really part of you. Now you have to be able to kick it out. It is very difficult to evict evils and vices once they dwell inside your heart, inside your character, inside your personality. It's very difficult. It is very difficult to resist temptations. Temptations, we have to deal with them day in and day out. So, these, I guess you see the picture. It is very difficult to successfully overcome these hardships. Now, mystics have argued that only love can enable us to succeed in this mission and in this endeavor. Faced with hardships of such struggles, many of us may lose our temper and become very agitated and inflexible. Have you noticed that when you go through your college exams during the finals week, you become moody, you become agitated, you tend to be very, sometimes you insult people out of nowhere. Why? Because these are hardships. When you face hardships in life, you tend to lose your temper. Eventually, you may lose any sense of balance in your character. And that's what happens to a lot of religious folks. When they encounter hardships on their spiritual development, they may reach a point where their character is out of balance. In other words, what does imbalance in character mean in religious terminology? Let me give you a bit of insight on that. I'm sure you've seen people who are so meticulous in doing their daily chores of religion and their daily observances. They are very meticulous. They are very detail-oriented when it comes to performing and executing the rituals of their faith. However, these very same people may become very ruthless and intolerant in dealing with those who do not share their convictions. It is astonishing how this contradiction can exist in a person. That it is they pay attention to the execution of the ritual so much. At the same time, these same people can become very ruthless and very intolerant in dealing with other human beings. How often has history witnessed religious zealots who are very strict when it comes to the proper execution of their prayers and observances, yet they are very lax when it comes to shedding the blood of non-believers? History is filled with such dark contrasts. Muslims are guilty of that. Christians are guilty of that. Jews are guilty of that. And again, it's one of those contradictions that it seems that many religious folks seem to feel comfortable with. It is a contradiction. Now, the question is this. What is lacking in the lives of these religious zealots that on the one hand makes them be so strict in observing rituals and very lax in observing the rites of other human beings? In my opinion, and in the opinion of most mystics, it is the lack of a compassionate heart. The lack of a compassionate heart. And the lack of tenderness of soul. You see, you can pray day in and day out all your life and not have a compassionate heart. You can do your prayers every day and not have tenderness in your soul. It is quite possible. Devotion to religion without love can quickly turn into dogmatism and hatred. Let me repeat one more time. Devotion to religion without love can quickly turn religion into dogmatism and hatred. The great contribution of mystics was to inject love into the religious life of their followers. That was a shot in the arm that basically transformed religions such as Islam from a rigid structure made of dry rules and commands with no spirit into a tremendous spiritual force that aided their followers in the ethical transformation of their characters. If it were not for mystics in Islam, in Christianity, in Judaism, and so forth, religion would be nothing but a set of dry rules, a lot of commandments with no spirit. The fundamental problem with Islamic fiqh or jurisprudence, in my opinion, is that it is a set of rules with no spirit, very rigid structure. And if that's the only viewpoint that you have on your religion, I submit to you that it can be very destructive. You're going to lose the balance in your character if you only appreciate religion as a set of eternal rules that you should follow and nothing beyond that. Now, there is nothing wrong with fiqh, obviously. What is wrong is with people who think that jurisprudence or fiqh is the only thing religion has to offer. This is a misunderstanding that we Muslims have to really correct. Let me make also a note of caution in this introduction. We must obey God's commands, period. We must obey God's command. Love does not replace prayers and observances. See, that's a misunderstanding that especially Iranians have. See, now these days Iranians are turned on by mysticism and the notion of love and all of that. So very often you hear Iranians, for example, say that it's only enough to have a pure and a clean heart, don't worry about your prayers. I'm not saying that. Mystics don't say that. It is very important to do your prayers. It is very important to do the rituals and rites of your religion. Love does not replace prayers. Love lies beyond prayers and observances. Love is added to prayers and observances, and thus it would help us reach God much quicker. Once you induce the notion of love in your religious life, you're going to seek God and you're going to reach God much quicker. Rumi, the great Iranian Muslim mystic, has a very nice poem. I say it first in Farsi, then I'm going to translate it into English. Zahid ba tars mi tazad bepa, aashiqan parrantar az barq o hava. He says that on the path to God, ascetics run with their feet. Lovers, on the other hand, fly. Both ascetics and lovers are on the move, yet running cannot compete with flying. Do you see the difference between the two? Ascetics, in Farsi, we call them zuhad, zahidan. And let me talk to you for a few minutes about asceticism. Ascetics typically rely on the fear of God. That's what they promote a lot. That's the first principle in zuhd or in asceticism. The second one is they emphasize a lot on prayers, fasting, solitude, and things like that. For those of you who are familiar with the Sufi tradition in Islam, chelle neshini, which means that you basically seek solitude for 40 consecutive nights, and in order to basically purify your soul and purify your heart. Very, very dry and tough regimen of prayers. Mortification is a third principle in there, which means breathtaking regimens to detach ourselves from worldly pleasures. This is the path that zuhad or ascetics have taken throughout history. Now Rumi is saying that ascetics, zuhad, definitely by going through these tough and rigorous exercises, they can walk towards God. Lovers, on the other hand, don't walk. They fly. Obviously, fly. Just imagine that you're going to walk your way to San Diego. Well, that's one way of doing it. The other one is to fly. And I guess we can all agree that flying will take you there much faster than walking. Let me give you an analogy so that you have a better appreciation of what Rumi is saying. Rumi uses the example of or the analogy of iron fillings. Imagine for a sec that you have a box filled with iron fillings and shavings. You're walking and suddenly you stumble over a piece of rock or you fall into a ditch. All the iron fillings and shavings are now scattered all around you. Now your task is to put all those iron fillings back into the box again. Well, according to Rumi, you have two options. Number one, get yourself a magnifying glass, right? And start collecting the fillings one at a time. Definitely you can succeed in putting all the fillings back into the box if you spend a long, long time. There is an easier way, though, to collect them. Can you guess what the easier option is? Find a magnet. Exactly. Get yourself a magnet and pull it over the iron shavings and iron fillings, and all of them will be attracted to the magnet. Love is that magnet. To mystics, love is the magnet that captivates you and attracts you to the divine, to God. It is precisely this captivating allure of God that makes it possible to endure the difficulties of your spiritual journey. If you don't have such a captivating magnet in your life, very soon you're going to become tired of looking for all those iron fillings. You're going to give up. See, a lot of people who start on the spiritual path with a lot of emotions and a lot of resolve initially, they tend to give up after a while. Have you seen people like that? They are gung-ho initially, you know. But after a while, they give up. The reason is they're missing that captivating allure. They're missing that magnet in their religious life. And the magnet, according to mystics, is really the love of God. Now, this was just an introduction to tell you what divine love is. So just very briefly to summarize, divine love is really a magnet. As you will find out, this magnet is nothing but having a set of eyes that can see the beauty in the world. See, the reason most of us cannot experience love in our lives is that we cannot find beauty in the world. Only people who have a set of beauty-seeking eyes can ever experience love in their lives. Not only love of another human being, but also the love of God. Now, what are some of the major characteristics of divine love? Let me share with you some of the most important ones. Now, everything that I say for the rest of the hour tonight applies equally to divine love as well as human love. It equally applies to both of them. But obviously, my intention is to discuss the characteristics of divine love. Especially for the younger folks in the audience, probably the rest of the lecture is of utmost importance, because I really think that a life void of love is not really worth living. And if you cannot truly love in your life, you would never ever experience life as a whole. The first important characteristic of love, divine or human, is the following. Love requires sacrifice. Love requires sacrifice. You see, love and ego do not mix. You either have ego or you have love. There is not room for both of them under the same roof. It's impossible to mix the two. For love to emerge, the ego in some sense has to be annihilated. And I know that this notion of annihilation is very rough to modern sensibilities. Annihilation, by the way, in Farsi and Arabic means fana. Fana of Allah that you've heard, that's what it means, annihilation. In other words, somehow we need to annihilate the large ego that we have if we want to appreciate love. Essentially, love is being absorbed by someone else rather than being absorbed with ourselves. So somehow you have to be absorbed by somebody else. Egotism, on the other hand, means being absorbed with one's self. Love requires going beyond one's self and self-interest. In other words, the ability to overcome a self-centered approach to life. Once egotism is overcome, then for the first time, a person can give and can forgive. See, egotistical people can never give and can never forgive. Only people who have overcome their egos are capable of doing that. And the primary ingredients of sacrifice are basically the two that I just mentioned. Giving and forgiving. In other words, love is a great teacher of sacrifice. Only people who are filled with love can make sacrifices in their lives. The soldiers who defend their homeland, they put their lives on the line, must be filled not with hatred. I mean, that may come second, but initially they may have hatred of the enemy, but they better have love for their own homeland. If they don't have that, sacrifice is impossible. If you want to give, and if you want to forgive, you must be able to sacrifice. And love, which is also basically very big on giving and forgiving, requires sacrifice. So rule number one then, in summary, people who want to experience love in their life, they better get used to making sacrifices in their lives. Characteristic number two of divine love. Love is aware. Love is aware. We should not confuse love with lust. You see, lust is infatuation. What does infatuation mean in English, by the way? Infatuation is a sort of intense attraction to somebody else. However, this intense attraction that you find to someone else, it has a few important characteristics. That's, by the way, how you can discern between love and lust. Most of us in modern world, we experience lust a lot, even when we want to get married. Very few of us ever experience love. So what are the characteristics of lust? First of all, it is a spike, a sudden rush of emotions, a sharp elevation of passions. Suddenly, your passions and your emotions go through the roof. It doesn't steadily go up. It's just like a spike. suddenly reaches the skies. Secondly, infatuation typically lasts for a short period of time, very short in duration. It comes down as quickly as it went up. It tapers off very quickly. That's what infatuation is. And by the way, you can be infatuated with God. Not just with a human being, but with God, we may be infatuated. I remember during the days of the Iranian Revolution, I was in college. Boy, we had an army of God lovers in Iran. 99% of Iranians just loved God. They craved God. A year later, 90% of them stopped praying. They were infatuated with God. Love of God is different. Just as you may be infatuated with another human being, and then a week later you file for divorce. A lot of people who go to Vegas to get married usually get divorced on the spot a week later. That's what happens. That's infatuation. It goes up very quickly, and it comes down very quickly. The third important feature of infatuation, it is based on faulty judgment. See, there is no reasoning beyond infatuation. No reasoning, no clear thinking. As if something eclipses our good sense of judgment. In other words, we are blinded. We cannot see. If I were to summarize this discussion on infatuation and lust, we can conclude that lust is blind, love is aware. See, don't ever say love is blind, because that's not. Lust is blind, love is aware. And let me also expose another misunderstanding in English language. You never, ever fall in love. You only fall into a ditch. And I mean it. See, that's a misunderstanding in English language. I don't know where that thing comes from. You never fall in love. You only fall in a ditch. Someone who is aware can never fall. Only people who have no idea what they do and where they're going, those who have not examined the terrain, can fall into a ditch. And that's what lust is all about. Love is aware. Now, awareness is such an integral part of mystic tradition that Islamic mysticism is really called Irfan. Irfan comes from the root word ma'rifat, meaning what? Knowledge. You see, Irfan, when you translate it into English, it means mysticism. But in Farsi and Arabic, we call it Irfan, which it just brings out the important element of knowledge, of awareness. In other words, Irfan, or Islamic mysticism, is a type of knowledge blended with love. Just imagine for a sec. Knowledge we only attribute to thinking, to comprehension, rational processes that go on in our head. Imagine for a sec if it would be possible to add love to comprehension. If it would be possible to blend the knowledge that we have, we blend it with love. If that could ever become a reality, the name for that would be Irfan or mysticism in the Islamic tradition. So, mystics' love rests on awareness. The mystic is fully aware of every step that he is taking towards God. In other words, God's light helps him find his way around much better. So in other words, a lover of God walks in light. What is one of the beautiful names of God in the Holy Quran is An-Nur, light. So when you seek God, you seek light. And when you find light, you would never fall into a ditch. Right? That's exactly what happens. That's why divine love is so important in our religious tradition. Now, lust originates in darkness. Love originates in light. Love is enlightening. Lust is blinding. You see the relationship between... I'm going very fast, obviously, and I apologize for that. Because the literature is so massive. I'm just giving you a taste for the notion of divine love in Islamic and Christian traditions. By the way, everything that I've said so far equally applies to Christianity and Islam. There's no difference between the two religions in that regard. Characteristic number three of divine love. Love is patient. Love is patient. Let me quiz you. How do you translate patience or perseverance into Arabic or the Quranic sense of the word? Sabr. Sabr. Isn't that amazing? That what the Quran preaches left and right is an important ingredient of love. Lust demands immediate gratification, right? We all know that. I want it quickly. Every time you have this kind of rush to have something very quickly, that's an indication that that's infatuation, that's lust. You want immediate, quick gratification. Love, on the other hand, preaches patience and perseverance. When you have love inside you, then love would whisper in your ear, be patient, be steadfast. On the other hand, when there is lust inside you a lot, the lust invites you to have things quickly. You never think. You never stop and evaluate. You never form a sound judgment. You act. You see, you go immediately from intention to action in lust and infatuation. You miss a lot of the steps in between. We are supposed to have an intention, then reflect, think, form an opinion, then act. See, infatuation skips all those important steps in the middle. That's why it's blinding. That's why you constantly fall when you have lust inside you. Again, love, on the other hand, says the exact opposite. Don't want something quickly. Wait. Be patient. That is the command of love. The Quran shares with us a very great wisdom. It's one of the most beautiful verses that I have found in the Quran that really ties a lot of the things that I've mentioned tonight together. Chapter 3, verse 142. أَمْ حَسِبْتُمْ أَن تَدْخُلُوا الْجَنَّةَ وَلَمَّا يَعْلَمُ اللَّهُ الَّذِينَ جَاهَدُوا مِنْكُمْ وَيَعْلَمُ الصَّابِرِينَ Did you think that you would enter paradise without God testing those of you who struggled hard and remained steadfast? Can you tell me what the three important words are in this verse that relates to my lecture tonight? تُدْخَلُوا الْجَنَّةِ Jannah is the first one, paradise. Then it talks about jihad, jahadu, which means a struggle. And then at the end, sabr, patience. Paradise is a metaphor for living in God in Islamic theology. Paradise really means a state of existence that you live in God and with God. That's what really paradise means. What the verse is saying is that paradise requires struggle. This struggle can only be undertaken by those who remain steadfast in the face of obstacles and hardships. This theme gets repeated in the Quran over and over and over. In order to go to Jannah, paradise, you have to struggle first with yourself. Not with the world out there. I submit to you, those of us who struggle with the world out there It's because we are struggling with ourselves. If we can overcome this internal struggle, then we will be at peace with the rest of the world. So, you want to enter paradise? You have to struggle with all the vices and evils that you have inside you. Don't attempt to uproot the evils out there. First, uproot the evils inside yourself. Who can undertake this struggle? Those who are patient. Those who are not patient are not cut out for this job. In other words, the spiritual journey towards God is not for quitters. Those who have a tendency to quit on relationships, they can never experience love. Now, whether this relationship is with another human being, with a cause, or with God, it doesn't matter. This spiritual quest is not for quitters. Hafez is one of the most important Iranian Muslim mystics. In his world-renowned collection of poems, he starts off with the following. Those of you who know Hafez, what is the very first poem that you find in his collection? Anybody? Ala ya ayyuhas saghi adir ka'san wa nawilha ke ishq asan namud awwal wali uftad mushkilha. This is so illuminating. In English, Hafez says, love appeared so easy at the outset, but tremendous hardships emerged later. See, love has a very inviting and pleasing appearance. It invites you. It attracts you towards itself. But the more you walk down the path towards your lover, the more hardships you will experience. And most of us will quit. We are not capable of enduring those hardships. And that's the experience that Hafez personally has had. He said, boy, I had no idea how tough it was. So those of you who want to get married, think twice. Because once you say, I love you, make sure you understand what you're saying. That's what Hafez is saying. I had no idea what I was saying. I just said, I love you. Hardships typically would follow. See, that's why awareness is so important. It's so important to know the terrain first. Right? Know the terrain before you commit. That's true of human love as well as divine love. A lot of people are turned on by Islam and Christianity these days. Again, like Hafez said, they have no idea what they are getting into. After Buddhism, the most difficult religion to adhere to is Christianity. It is very, very difficult, next to impossible, to live like Jesus Christ, peace be upon him. If you ask me why Christian theologians later decided to make Jesus Christ Lord and God, it was precisely because no one could live, no human being could ever live like Jesus Christ. It's very easy to put a cross on your chest. This is that inviting a Lord that I was talking about. Practicing what that cross signifies is very, very difficult. Muslims, exactly the same way. It is very easy to grow beard and change your name from Joe to Muhammad. That is the easy part. The tough part, to lead a life in accordance with the teachings of the Holy Quran. That is a difficult part. Now, I was talking about the fact that love is patient. You see, birth and life in general are intertwined with struggle, with pain, and with suffering. Those in the audience, those females in the audience who have given birth to a child know exactly what I'm talking about. Giving life, having life, is next to impossible without pain and suffering. Until mom goes through a lot of pain, a new life cannot begin. It's a metaphor, obviously. A spiritual rebirth and rejuvenation is no exception. You see, spiritual rebirth requires prohibition, saying no to your basic instincts. Isn't that what we do during the month of Ramadan? We are supposed to say no to our basic instincts. What are our basic instincts? To eat, to drink, to basically have sex, and then suddenly you are required by Islam to stop that for a fairly lengthy period of time during every 24-hour period. So you learn to say no to your basic instincts. See, you cannot practice any religion without having the ability to say no. Ethical behavior rests on prohibition. Now, I submit to you that spiritual rebirth and spiritual rejuvenation is also impossible without having the ability to resist your instinctive demands. Now, in order to be able to say no to your basic instincts, you have to be very patient. See, you want to drink a glass of water. That's one way Muslims, by the way, practice patience. You really, really, you're tired. You're thirsty. You want to grab the bottle of water and start drinking. You stop. This is how you develop patience in yourself. To sum up, a hallmark of those who are in love is patience. In other words, sticking it out when the going gets rough, not abandoning a relationship when challenges appear. Principle number 4, love is reciprocal. In other words, love is a two-way street. Here is the fun part of the lecture. Each partner in a loving relationship is committed to reciprocate. If reciprocity takes root in a relationship, love can flourish. If, however, one party gives and the other party only takes, there is no love. You have selfishness. Love cannot flourish under such circumstances. Love is reciprocal. It's a two-way street. Any relationship founded on selfishness is doomed to fail, obviously. No party can forever give without getting anything back in return. That's why most of the relationships we have just fall apart as quickly as they are formed. Because typically one party is expected to give all the time and the other party does not reciprocate. Now, to explore this dimension of divine love, I'm going to use the Christian conception of love, which is very beautiful. I really, really enjoy the concept of love in Christianity. So again, I'm talking about the fact that love is reciprocal. It requires reciprocity, and I'm going to draw upon Christian theology for this part of the lecture. You see, in English, we only have one word to describe different positive feelings or affections we may have towards other people, towards other things. We have only one word, and that's love. For example, I might say, I love my car. Then 5 minutes later I say, I love my cat. Then I say 5 minutes after that, I love my wife. And then in the evening I say, I love God. We use one word, we love God, we love cat. We love our wife, we love our husband, we love our children, and we love our car. One word that we use to describe the positive feelings that we have in English. The Greeks, on the other hand, had different words, many words, to express the feelings they had. Each word would basically, it was based on the nature or the content of the feeling. Let me talk about three important words the Greeks had whenever they wanted to express the positive affections and feelings that they had. And those words, by the way, were embraced by Christian theology and is part of their theology now. The first word is Aaron. Aaron. You've heard of the word eros, right? In Freudian psychology, eros is basically sexual love. Eren actually goes beyond sexual love. Eros exclusively means sensual desires, the desires and pleasures we get out of the five senses we have. Sexual, obviously, sexual pleasure and sexual love is eros. Now, Eren is not entirely sensual. It can also include non-sensual gratification. For example, when you satisfy an intellectual curiosity you have, right? That also can be considered Eren in Greek. Eren is a type of love that consumes all on itself. Let me repeat, because that is the hallmark of Eren. It is a love that consumes all on itself. What would be a good example of such a love? A love that is all-consuming unto itself. The Greeks would use the example of a baby's love for his mother. A baby's love for his mom is considered Eren in Greek and also in Christian theology. What is the nature of this type of love? Well, this type of love is a one-way street. A baby turns to his mom to find peace and security. The baby's motive for loving his mom is his own needs. In other words, a five-month-old baby has really no idea what true love is. Yes, as soon as mom leaves the room, he starts crying for his mom. Why? Because he needs security, he needs milk, he needs stuff like that. So a baby's love for his mom is out of basic personal motives. This type of love grows out of concern for one's own needs, right? When somebody is concerned with only his or her own needs, yes, this person can experience love, but that love would be Eren, basically. It is a sort of selfish love. It is an attitude of give me, give me, give me. That's that is the motto of this type of love. Requires giving, by the other party all the time. This sort of love can exist as long as the loved one can fulfill the baby's needs. If mom stops providing for the baby is not going to love his mom anymore. So it is very conditional on what the baby receives. Now, every one of us is born with Eren. Every single one of us is born with Eren. However, it is quite natural for a 7-8 pounder to have Eren. It is not okay for a 150-pounder to still have Eren. And that's our problem. It's as if some of us never grow out of Eren. Some of us keep the Eren forever in our lives. That type of love is meant to assist us in our childhood. And we are supposed to turn our back to that type of love when we grow as adults. And unfortunately, some of us along the way forget to leave the Eren behind. So that's the first type of love then. The second type of love, according to Christian theology, is agape. The word is Greek, but it was popularized by Christianity. You see, agape is the love that the mother has for her baby. Eren is the love that baby has for his mom. Agape is the other way around, the love of mom for her baby. Now, what is baby's hope when he cries out all the time, give me, give me, give me? His hope is that his mom would say, okay, okay, okay. That is the only hope that he has. Now, agape is a love that grows out of a heart that prizes the other more than herself. A heart that can experience agape as love focuses more on the needs of the other party than herself. That is the hallmark of agape. Now, agape has three important qualities, very briefly. Number one, agape does not count the cost. Mothers never calculate the cost of providing for their babies. It doesn't matter even if they have no money whatsoever. They do whatever it takes to make sure that the baby is well fed. Now, for those of you who are falling asleep, let me give you a quiz. In terms of divine love, what does it mean not to calculate cost? It simply means that yes, you may pray all your life and your wishes may not be granted. But agape means don't worry about that, right? You focus more on the beloved rather than on yourself. That is the fundamental principle behind agape. Agape does not count the cost. Principle number two for agape, it does not evaluate whether the receiving person is even worth it. Are you with me? Do you understand what the love of Jesus Christ for humanity is all about? You provide love to other people without even evaluating whether they are worth it. This is not the way we typically operate, is it? We always do a lot of homework to make sure that the receiving person is worth what we're giving you. Agape says no. Do not consider the worth of the person who receives your love. Principle number three for agape. Agape never stops. It never stops. Even if a child becomes a criminal, rejected by the society, he can rest assured that he still has a shelter in the arms of his mom. Agape never stops. It continues forever. That's what agape is. Now, important consideration here. Agape, above all, should be invested only on another human being or God. Don't ever invest agape on material things. See, that's another flaw that we have. Sometimes, salamu alaikum, sometimes we invest agape on material things. And that's why we experience disappointment in life. You remember initially I started off that, you know, the 1 minute discussion on religion, and I mentioned that we live in tragic conditions in our lives, constant disappointments and so forth. Now you see where it's coming from? Because our love is misplaced. Agape is a love that should be placed only on another human being or on God. In other words, it should be only invested on that which has the potential to respond to love. It has the potential to reciprocate. In other words, agape should be invested in a relationship. You can never have a relationship with your car, can you? Your car cannot reciprocate your love. If you are ignorant, if you live in darkness, and you misplace your agape, you're going to be disappointed. So if you do spend your agape on something that cannot respond to your love, you're going to be disappointed. Now, the third type of love. So far we talked about Aaron that consumes all the love unto himself. Agape that only gives love to another party. The third type is called phleo. Phleo is the reward or response to agape. In other words, agape is the basis, the foundation of phleo. When you channel your energy into loving someone, you will receive a response, and that response is of being loved. Right? That's the response that typically you would get. The act of loving will eventually awaken the other party. The act of loving will eventually bring forth the love in the other person. Now, do you see why Jesus Christ, peace be upon him, insisted that if somebody slaps you in the face, turn the cheek? When you love somebody, ultimately, if you keep doing that, if you have perseverance, if you remain steadfast, ultimately that other party will succumb, will submit to your love, and he or she will reciprocate. Now, most of us are not that patient. We give up, right? Jesus Christ was inviting us not to let go, not to give up. Ultimately, the other party will have to respond. Now, phileo is mutual love. It's a relationship based on sharing. Christians would call it brotherly love. Phileo is the love that exists between those who love and are loved back. This is adult love. Aaron was the baby's love, right? Phileo is adult love that requires maturity. For those of you who are well-versed in the Holy Quran, do we have the notion of phileo in the Holy Quran? Have you seen a verse in the Quran that resembles the Christian notion of phileo? Yes, actually there is. And I recited that verse to you last time I was here. I'm not going to elaborate. I'm going to just give you the reference in the Holy Quran and the English translation. Chapter 5. Verse 54, O you who have faith, if you revert from your religion, then God will substitute in your place people whom he will love them as they will love him. يُحِبُّهُمْ وَيُحِبُّونَ God loves them and they love God back. This is identical to the Christian notion of phileo. So again, there is no difference between the Islamic and Christian theology when it comes to the notion of phileo. Last characteristic of divine love that I'm going to talk about tonight. Ultimate love is unconditional. Ultimate love is unconditional. You see, phileo requires the attitude that I will give with no expectation of getting anything back. If both parties have this attitude, if both parties operate on this principle, then phileo can emerge. If you notice, unconditionality is assumed in phileo. Each party gives unconditionally. But since both parties give unconditionally at their intersection, you have phileo. So in a sense, you cannot have phileo without having unconditional love. But I want to talk about unconditionality of love in greater detail. This time, let me draw upon the Islamic heritage. For the other principle, I use the Christian heritage. Now let's talk about the Islamic heritage to examine this aspect of love. Specifically, I will share with you the wisdom of Imam Ali, the first Shi'i saint in this regard. You see, people may have different motives for turning to God. People can have a lot of different motives when they turn to God. Imam Ali classifies people of faith into three categories based upon their motives. Now, we can take his categorization and come up with a typology. You know what typology means? the ideal type, as Max Weber says in sociology. In other words, we have three types of people. Each one of us will fall into one of those categories. Now, what are those three categories? Well, the first category, according to Imam Ali, إِنَّ قَوْمًا عَبَدُ اللَّهَ رَحْبَةً فَتِلْكَ عِبَادَةِ الْعَبِيدِ. That's the Arabic from Nahj al-Balagha, right? The English translation. There are those who worship God in the hope of avoiding hellfire. And this is the slave's worship. Isn't that fascinating? You can have a slave mentality when you worship God. You see, this type of folks only act in order to avoid pain. The slave's motive for obeying his master's wishes is basically not to get whipped. That's his only motive for obeying the dictations of the master. It is fear of the whip that motivates the slave to work, because he does not want to get whipped. Fear of punishment shapes the behavior of those who have the slave mentality. You see, some of us may even go to UC Berkeley, graduate with PhD, and still have a slave mentality in our daily lives. If we act based upon fear, we do have a slave mentality. In modern terminology, we can classify these type of folks as risk averse. These folks want to avert risk. They want to minimize their cost. They do not really want to make a kill in life to win a lot of profit in their investment. They just want to maintain the status quo by and large. Now, I submit to you that the prevailing view in theistic religions, Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, their view of God throughout history has by and large been God as the master. Let me talk for a few minutes about this notion, because it is very critical. In their view, God has created men to serve Him. God created humanity to worship Him, to praise Him. In this view of the world, there exists a master-servant relationship between man and God. God is like a benevolent sovereign who reigns over his subjects. God issues commands, and the servant obeys unconditionally. It's as if from on high, God scrutinizes his subject's behavior, looking for any excuse to punish, looking for any excuse to send offenders to hell. Am I exaggerating here? I really don't think so. Isn't that the concept that most people have of God? It's as if God is very, very unforgiving, that He is looking for an excuse to send us to hell. If you review the theology of most religions, you will come across this tendency in them. Not that these religions authentically promote this view, but for whatever reason, their adherents have this notion, inaccurate notion, of God. Now, if you ever have this notion of God, then the code of conduct that you embrace will be compatible with a God as a tyrannical master, not a beautiful and loving God. Only a tyrannical master will subject his servants to hellfire for any minute discrepancy that they may have. As such, for these folks, fear forms the bond connecting them to God. Just as fear alone binds the slave to his master, here is a problem. As soon as fear loosens, so does the bond. See, as soon as the fear goes away, then the bond to God will weaken. If it were not really for the fear of punishment, the slave would not submit to the will of his master. If it were not for the looming hellfire, the slave would not carry on the commands of his master. Now, another offshoot of this type of relationship with God is sternness, gloom, and grimness. Most zealous and devout Muslims, at least in the Iranian community that I've seen, they are grim-faced. They are very stern. What is the favorite color amongst Iranian devout Muslims? Black. It's black. Am I exaggerating on that? This is exactly what happens when your view of God is one of a tyrannical master. That's one of the offshoots of this relationship based on fear with God. The religious folks who are very resentful and intolerant of others typically fall into this category that Imam Ali is saying. In the eyes of such reclusive and withdrawn people, God appears as a jailer and man is his captive. The jailer's watchful eyes follow the captive wherever he goes. That's precisely the impression that a lot of religious folks have of God. They are always afraid that something bad is going to happen to them. Now, God's presence in a person's life as a jailer or a tyrannical master would ultimately create a code of conduct that amounts to shackle, bondage, and limitations. Anyhow, a heart that is filled with gloom and resentment can hardly rejoice life. How often do we come across religious zealots who are cheerful, who are jubilant, and who are joyful? For them, this world represents a prison. One can hardly have a life in a prison. One can hardly experience happiness in a prison. No wonder why these folks want to experience life in the afterworld. So they want to postpone that. We want to be miserable here and happy over there. You cannot be any more wrong than that. If you are unhappy here, you will definitely be unhappy over there. And I submit to you, those who cannot experience heaven on earth would never enter heaven in the afterlife. It's impossible. We may not be able to establish heaven in society, but sure we can establish heaven inside ourselves. If we do not have a taste of heaven inside, we are not fit to enter heaven in the afterlife. Now, no wonder that sadness, sorrow, and weeping is viewed by many as the hallmark of religiosity and faith in our Islamic folk culture. And I want to reiterate, Islamic folk culture. Not that Islam necessarily promotes or endorses this culture. Not at all. But somehow, unfortunately, our folk culture glorifies gloom, sadness, sorrow, and weeping. On the contrary, it seems as if joy, smile, cheer, and beauty symbolizes weakness of faith and recklessness. One observation I have, in Iran, for example, most people, when they want to go to mosque, they usually do not dress very well. When they go to parties, they put on their most elegant dress. When you go to the party of God, you must put on your best dress, your best perfume. You must be happy when you see God, not gloomy. You should have a smile on your face when you go to the party of God. You shouldn't weep. The second category, according to Imam Ali, إِنَّ قَوْمًا عَبَدُ اللَّهُ رَغَبَةً فَتِلْكَ عِبَادَةُ التُّجَّارِ. There are those who worship God in the hope of paradise, and this is the businessman's worship. عِبَادَةُ التُّجَّارِ. The first type were slaves, right? The second types are businessmen. These folks would engage in good deeds only if numbers add up. They won't do anything good unless they see a benefit in it for them. In other words, to the businessman, reward is external to a good deed. The deed itself is not rewarding. The reward comes as a result of the deed. These folks are driven to good deeds by the profit motive. That's why Imam Ali called them businessmen. Business folks are driven by the profit motive in any endeavor they make. The business folks in religiosity do not gravitate to goodness because of the inherent beauty of an act, but rather because of the promise of a manifold return on their investment. I pray, but what is it in it for me? What am I going to get? In other words, these business folks in religiosity have not acquired yet the eyes, nor have they acquired the taste that gets fulfillment from the sheer act of doing good. See, those who are immature in religiosity, they cannot see the beauty in charity. They cannot yet see the beauty in prayer. They cannot see the beauty in submission. That's why their motto is, what is in it for me? Any act I do must give me something in return, and that usually has to be something tangible. The third category, وَإِنَّ قَوْمًا عَبَدُ اللَّهُ شُكْرًا فَتِلْكَ عِبَادَةُ الْأَحْرَارِ. There are those who worship God to express their appreciation for the opportunity to praise Him. And this is the worship of the free. Isn't that beautiful? So we have three categories there. The slaves, business folks, and the free. Now, when Imam Ali says these are the free, who are the free? The free are those who are free from considerations of hell and paradise. Whatever they do, they have no regard whatsoever for hell or paradise. They are free from those considerations. In other words, Ahrar, the free, have transcended the cost-benefit paradigm in religiosity. They have transcended the pain-pleasure paradigm in religiosity. The free gravitate to goodness because of its sheer beauty and elegance. To them, goodness is an end in itself. Goodness is not good for something else. Goodness is good for itself. In other words, the reward is in the act itself. The reward is not outside the action. So it seems as if Imam Ali is giving us a good tool for self-assessment. Anytime you do something and the reward you expect resides outside the action itself, you are either a slave or a businessman. You are not free yet. You have not entered the rank of Ahrar, according to Imam Ali. Now, the Ahrar, the free, have reached true enlightenment. They find joy and fulfillment in living in accordance with a wisdom inspired by God. It is the touch of God that gives them joy. Once when God touches them in their lives, they gain true joy out of that. The Quranic word for goodness is ihsan, right? What is the root word for ihsan? Husn. One of the meanings of husn is beauty. Ihsan means to act beautifully in the world. To act beautifully in the world. Telling the truth is beautiful. Telling a lie is ugly. Being honest is beautiful. Being deceitful is ugly. See, that's, I think, how we Muslims should look at our theology. Ihsan is beautiful. Anything that God says do are inherently beautiful. And by the way, إِنَّ اللَّهَ جَمِيلٌ وَيُحِبُّ الْجَمَالِ. God is beautiful and He loves beauty. Isn't that what Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, told us? God is beautiful. Everything that God has created is beautiful. God never creates anything that is ugly. It only requires that we have a pair of beauty-seeking eyes to see beauty in everything that exists. That's precisely what Jesus Christ was teaching us. See, there is no one in the world beneath our mercy. There is no one in the world that is not worth our compassion. Even Pharaoh. Even the Pharaohs of the world are still human beings. It is fascinating, by the way. Let me take a detour. When God in the Holy Quran asks Moses to go and talk to Pharaoh, how does God address Moses? Does God say, Moses, go to this guy who is an idiot called Pharaoh? Does God talk like that? No. Allah says, go talk to my servant. Pharaoh is still an abd of God. Allah is teaching Moses not to think that just because he is a prophet of God, God has given him a license to denigrate Pharaoh. Are you with me? Is this how we behave? Is it how we live? Far from it. You see, for us, things are black and white. A small minority who happen to be like us, they are great dudes. They are worthy of going to heaven. The majority of humanity are beneath God's compassion. They are destined for hellfire. It's as if God has allocated a lot more space in this beautiful universe to hell rather than paradise. Whereas that's not really the case. No one in the world is beneath our compassion and our mercy. And that's the lesson that we learn from Islamic and Christian mysticism. Now, for the free, worship is not an instrument in the service of material well-being. Rather, worship is an expression of submission to the truth and ultimate beauty. In other words, worship would elevate our soul, not our standards of living. In other words, from now on, when you start praying after your salat, be careful what you ask God. Worship is meant to elevate our soul, not really our standards of living. We need to correct our attitude towards our theology. Rumi, the great Iranian mystic, once said, "An gada guyad khuda az bahre nan, muttaqi guyad khuda az ayn jan." The needy seeks God for bread. The pious turns to God from the depth of his soul. Yes, both of them say, O God, but for different motives. One wants something from God. The pious does not want anything from God. In other words, for those who live in dire circumstances just to survive, God would manifest himself as the Lord of the wretched of the earth, Rabbul Mustad'afin. Right? You remember during the heydays of the Iranian Revolution, a lot of us would start our lectures by saying, rather than Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, we would say, Bismi Rabbil Mustad'afin. It's as if for us, God manifested himself as the Lord of the wretched of the earth. One that puts bread on the table. One that beats down on the oppressor. One that avenges the victimized. One that pays the debt of the debtors. This is the portrait of God for a lot of religious folks. However, once these rudimentary needs are met, and we are free from mundane preoccupations, then suddenly divine beauty will manifest itself in more sublime level. Then God suddenly would appear as a beloved to us rather than the Lord of the wretched of the earth. God will suddenly lose his appeal as a savior and appear as a beautiful beloved. That's how God appears to mystics. As we say in Farsi, yek ma'shuq nazanin, ma'shuq nazanin. And worshipping this God obviously requires a qualitatively different mindset and a different taste of worshipping. Imam Ali's typology has been embraced by Muslim mystics throughout ages, and I want to quickly summarize my lecture and finish. I know that I've gone over time tonight again. Imam Ali's typology involves a categorization of the people of faith as the following. Either they have the slave mentality, which means they are motivated by fear in everything they do. The second type of human beings are those who are motivated by profit. The third are free from the cost-benefit paradigm. They are free from considerations of hell and paradise. Now, this typology of Imam Ali has been embraced by Muslim mystics throughout ages. One of them is called Rabi'ah, who is one of the women mystics in the Islamic world, who lived 1300 years ago in Basra. Rabi'ah encapsulated the teachings of Imam Ali into a very beautiful prayer. And those of you who have these kind of mystic inclinations, you may want to recite her prayer after your salat. O my Lord, if I worship you for fear of hell, burn me in hell. And if I worship you for hope of paradise, exclude me from it. But if I worship you for your own sake, do not withhold from me your eternal beauty. See, that's the prayer of a mystic. That's the prayer of a mystic. Rumi had also a very loving relationship with God, and his poem is very illuminating in that regard. من تخت نمی خواهم من تاج نمی خواهم در خدمتت افتاده بر روی زمین میخواهم آن یار نکوی من بگرفت گلوی من گفتا که چه میخواهی گفتم که همین خواهم. Now the English translation. Rumi says, I do not aspire to have the peacock throne. All I wish for is to be worthy of being a humble servant living in your proximity. The beloved grabbed my throat, squeezing, and asked, what do you want from me? And I replied, simply this. That's all I'm asking for, that you squeeze my throat. When God squeezes us, it means he actually cares for us. What Rumi is saying in poetic language is the following: I accept all the pain and suffering as gifts from God. I am content with His plan for my life and for my day, and I thank Him for each of His gifts, large and small, painful or pleasurable. The Beloved knows what is best for my soul. That is the definition, the classical definition of contentment, rida, being pleased with whatever God brings forth for us. I will stop right here, and inshallah, if I have an opportunity in the future, I will delve deeper into the notion of divine love. Let me summarize my lecture tonight. Divine love is really like a magnet that attracts us towards God. It is the alluring magnet of God. It is the sheer beauty of God that would make it possible to sustain the hardships of the path towards the divine. Love is not lust. Love is not infatuation. And I went over some of the major characteristics of divine love. Let me quiz you just to make sure you got it. What was the first characteristic of divine love? Love requires sacrifice. The second one. Love is aware. Third principle or characteristic. Love is patient. Number four. Love is reciprocal. Number five. Ultimate love is unconditional. This is a summary of what divine love is all about. I really thank your attention tonight, and I apologize for going way over time in my lecture, and God bless you all. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.